All right, it's good to be back here, having class here. Being able to look out, seeing everybody's faces is really good, or at least part of your faces. We're going to get into Job chapters 1 and 2 today, and we'll see how far we get. The plan is if we can get through all of that material, which I'm suspicious we won't. Next week, plan to cover chapter 3. So whatever we don't get done this week on chapter 2 and then chapter 3 next week. So read ahead, at least cover chapter 3 next for next week. Job chapter 1, last week, if you weren't in the class, we just kind of went through an overview of what we know about the book of Job. We talked about what do we know about who wrote it, when it was written, and to summarize very quickly, not a lot. There's just not a lot of information out there, but we kind of went through what, here's how the scholars would approach, like a textual scholar would approach trying to date the book. We looked at a little bit of rabbinic tradition, like if you watched a YouTube video of a rabbi teaching on Job, he would tell you definitively Moses wrote it, because that's the rabbinic tradition. But, you know, outside of that tradition, I don't know of a lot of evidence for that, or anybody else who may have written it. But if you have any questions about any of that, let me know. I'm happy to share my notes from that class. If you'd like to look into some of the resources that I gained from preparing for that class, I'd be happy to share those with you as well. So now we're going to get into the text. Job chapter 1. And I would like to start by reading verses 1 through 5. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. So what do you take from these first 5 verses? What can we learn about this man, Job? He's very wealthy, very blessed.
Big family.
He has a big family, and he loves his family. And you get a sense for, like, the tightness of the family, right? They're having these feasts, like, you know, day after day, and they're all together in the house, you know, being together.
He cared for. He was a very good father.
So what do you make of this offering, these burnt offerings, just on the chance that maybe one of his children had sinned? Yeah, I think that that's included there as, to help us understand about this man's character. He is proactively looking out for the spiritual well-being of his family. He's very wealthy and he's taking care of them that way, but he's very, very engaged, like to a almost uber degree, looking after their spiritual well-being as well. Anything else? Yeah, Kelly?
And this is prior to the law of Moses. He understands, like Abraham did, his father sacrificed. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, being mindful of the things of God that he had to do, seeking God.
Yeah, and We can assume that pretty easily, especially to keep going in chapter 1, how God refers to him as exemplary in his righteousness, right? So he knows what God wants him to do, and he does it. He has a knowledge of those things. Sean?
And just on that, this is not it does teach us that even though man has fallen short, it is okay to talk about people in a realistic, practical way. It talks about Job as a man who was righteous.
Yeah. Yeah, just it's a, it seems like a simple observation, but worth noting. You know, God noticed him and called him out for his righteousness, for his good deeds that he did. That God was very pleased with him. You know, this idea here at the beginning in verse 1 where the narrator says that he was blameless and upright. He feared God and turned away from evil. As we go throughout the book of Job, Job's character is going to come into question, right? But this is the narrator speaking, all right? I don't think that the book of Job was intended for us to question the judgment of the narrator, and much less the judgment of God, because we have God's assessment of his character as well. We should go into this discourse and remember throughout it that Job is a good man, and he is exemplary in his righteousness. Okay? Yeah, Kelly? Yeah, the totality of his character, he's trying to seek God, not that he's a, obviously he's not a sinless individual. Yes? God isn't shy about giving his assessment of certain characters in the Old Testament. There's men like Job. No other person on earth is like this man. And then there's people like Eli's sons. These are worthless men. Right? They are worthless. Why is it important that we see Job in this way heading into this? Well, I think that what we're setting ourselves up for is we're going to be challenging God's judgment. And who's our best candidate to be challenging God's judgment throughout this study other than a man who's exemplary in righteousness? Right? We can't really find a flaw in his character. And he seems like he's going to be a victim in all of this. Right? We have every reason to believe if anybody has a case to take before God, it's this man. Right? There's no one else who's as righteous as this man. And we're going to see how he handles the trials initially as well. And how he really does a good job of that. But, you know, as we'll notice, and as it is the case, I think, with us, when you are being or going through suffering, if you've ever suffered physically, and I have to just a tiny degree, nothing like a lot of even you have, nothing like Job has. But the continual experience of that can just drain you and work on your mind and work on your attitude, and it can degrade that. Okay. So let's move along. Let's look at verses 6 and 7. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." Now it's interesting that I, you know, up until a year ago, I had just assumed, because I hadn't thought about it, that this is speaking of the devil, capital S, Satan. And it might be, but there's actually two schools of thought on this, and I just wanted to present the two schools of thought as to who this character is. And you can judge for yourself and determine if it's really even important. But either this is the devil, the same being that we see in the garden scene who deceived Eve with the fruit and caused the fall of man, or it's some other spiritual being. besides that particular person, that the devil. So why might some believe it's referring to the devil, as in the father of lies, capital S, Satan? Well, the description Satan becomes what the devil is referred to in the New Testament. So we read about him being called Satan in the New Testament. Jesus refers to him this way. So our knowledge now, living when we do and having the New Testament and looking back at Job, our knowledge of the New Testament would be informing our understanding of Job, because we see Satan in the New Testament. That's Satan, 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 right? And then this character, I mean, admittedly, he seems kind of like a nasty creature to me. He challenges God's judgment of Job's character. And he seems to act without any pity on Job and what he's doing to Job. That's just how it looks to me. Okay, maybe that's not what's going on, but that's how it looks to me. So those are just a couple of reasons why some people would believe this is the capital S, Satan. Okay, and then I want to talk about why some people might believe it's not him. But yeah, Kelly? Yeah, and that's what the Hebrew word literally means, is accuser, prosecutor. Like the idea is like going to court and someone who's making a case against someone else. Now, some believe this is not referring to the devil, and here are some reasons. So scholars of the ancient Hebrew, if you think about people who are scholars of both the language and the culture of ancient Hebrew, they see no reason to associate this being with the serpent in the garden. They would tell you that if someone was hearing this back, like when Job was written originally, if they were hearing this or reading this, that wouldn't be obvious to them that this is talking about the same person. I mean, within their frame of mind, right? They wouldn't automatically associate this guy as being the same one in the garden who deceived Eve. Again, the word Satan has a definite article in front of it. So it's actually the Satan, okay? And if Satan is a name, then it's a little awkward. It's like saying the Dusty, you know? It's better understood as a description of a being and not a name. Okay, so whether or not that's describing the father of lies and the devil or some other being, it's describing this character. Okay. This term, the Satan, is used elsewhere in the Old Testament where it obviously does not refer to the devil. So another argument there, for example, if we go to Numbers 22:22, you want to flip over there. And Numbers 22:22 reads, but and this is the example of Balaam, but God's anger was kindled because he went, Balaam, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as his Satan. But here it's translated adversary, but there's no difference in the Hebrew. He stood as a Satan in his way, as an adversary, as one who was against him. Okay, obviously this angel that God sent is not the devil and the father of the lies to stand between Balaam and where he was going. There's other examples as well. 1 Chronicles 21. And verse 1, it reads, then Satan stood against Israel and incited David to number Israel. So that could be ambiguous, but then let's cross-reference that to 2 Samuel 24, which is talking about the same event. And in 2 Samuel 24, verse 1, it says, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, go number Israel and Judah. So a lot of times what you see in the Old Testament, when God sends his angel to do something, there's a blending between God and the angel. And they're often referred to as kind of like one and the same. And I think you have that happening here as well. If you look at 1 Chronicles 21 and 2 Samuel 24, you have this being, this Satan, who's acting on behalf of God because God was angry with the people. Okay, so not doesn't really make sense if that's the father of lies, right? And God has also given this role to some humans in raising up adversaries against Israel. If you go to 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 14, it reads, "And the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was of the royal house in Edom." So Hadad the Edomite was a Satan, in the sense of the word that's being used here. So we see, just making the point, it's not uncommon in the Old Testament to see this term used to describe the function of an individual. So it doesn't necessarily mean that's the father of lies. So some other evidence someone might say if they believe that this is not the devil. Going back to Job chapter 1, just contextually, this being is being admitted into God's throne room. He's walking among them freely as one of the sons of God, it seems. Like, that's the most obvious interpretation. And, you know, certainly God can let in whomever he wants to let in for any reason. But, you know, there's a little bit of difficulty if you're interpreting this as God conversing with the leader of the rebellion so conversationally in his own throne room. And then the other thing is, like, this being, when he goes and he starts tormenting Job, he's acting by the authority of God. God grants him the authority to do that. Whereas the devil, we know, is a rebel. He acts as he wants to, regardless of God's authority. So this being's behavior seems more consistent with an angel who's sent to do God's will, just for whatever it's worth. So if it's not the devil, then what we have is a spiritual being who's doing his job. This is what he does. This is his function. But he doesn't seem too compassionate towards Job, to say the least. And he's not impressed with Job like God is. So why does it matter? Or does it matter? Well, the only thing I'll offer is, if we interpret that this character is the devil, I think the only risk there is that when we read of all of the bad things that happened to Job, we might just quickly say, well, it's the devil's fault. It's the devil being the devil, right? He's doing what he's doing, and we blame Satan, capital S, Satan, for everything that happened. But I don't think that's the point of Job. I don't think that's what we're supposed to take away from Job. I think that the conflict that's being debated throughout the book of Job that we get into, and the ideas that are being explored in this book, have to do with the conflict between God and man, not between the devil and man. It's between God. I mean, Job and his friends are debating, is it just for God to allow these things to happen? So I don't think the hearer or the reader is intended to blame the devil if this is the devil, but rather contemplate with Job and his friends as they work through these arguments, why would God allow this to happen? Okay, so just for whatever it's worth, I don't draw a hard line either way. I think those are pretty good arguments either way, and it's enough to make me step back and say, maybe I'll lean that it's not the devil, but I'm not really confident preaching that as like it's definitely not the devil. Yeah, Kelly? The devil or this being?
No, the devil.
Yes, I think you can look to the verses like 1 Corinthians 10:13. You know, no temptation is overtaking you, but what's common to man, God won't allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. So I do think there's restraints that are put upon his power. Yeah. So it could be that, right?
Yeah. I'm not suggesting that means that's the devil
here. No, it's a good observation. Yeah. It's a good observation.
God allows him. He has
I don't have a lot of, I don't relate to this character either way very much. I don't have a lot of compassion for him, and he seems kind of like the enemy. He seems like he's not too impressed with humans. Yeah.
It's just a thought, too, but you have this picture that Jesus presents where angels are rejoicing over faithfulness, you know?
Yeah.
So it is odd that this person, at the very best, seems different to the whole thing at best.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good observation. And, you know, the fact that he's, whoever this being is challenging God's judgment. Because God, as we read, God's going to say, hey, have you considered Job? And he's like, I think you're wrong about that one. Kind of interesting. Okay, let's go back to Job chapter 1. And let's read verses 8 through 22. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. And the Sabians fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people. And they are all dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. So what do you make of the challenge that the Satan presents to God? What's going on here in this throne room? What is this debate, this challenge all about? Yeah, Jeff?
It's a curious thing to me. Here's God Almighty. He knows the answer to this. He's God, right? He knows Job's heart. And it just seems a little strange to me that he would let this being disrespected, because that's essentially what he's doing. He says, but now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Like, he's telling God something that God can't understand on his own. I don't know, it's
all very curious. Yeah, it is. You know, to your point, you know, God had already formed a conclusion about Job. Right, so what's interesting here is what we talked about earlier, God's judgment about Job's characters being challenged by the Satan. But that's something that's a theme that's going to continue throughout the book, God's judgment being challenged. This Satan character does it, Job's going to do it when we get into chapter 3 and on, as he makes a defense for himself. He's challenging God. I know you're God, but I don't think you got this one right. And Job's friends are going to do it as well. I mean, maybe we'll see as we read in their answers and their thoughts that they're going to give to Job. But the way that they challenge God's judgment is they're presuming to be able to predict how God operates in their answers to Job. And if God doesn't operate this way that I understand him to operate, then he's not a just God. So there must be a problem with you, Job. But it's kind of an indirect challenge to God's judgment. It's like, if God's not acting in this way, that basically means you're a sinner, Job, then God's not just. And this theme of God's justice being challenged is going to happen with all these different people. Yeah, Joel?
So, more so than any conversation I've had with people and their reluctance to be as genuine or not why do good things happen to bad people? Why do bad things happen to good people? Books have been written, arguments have been made, and fundamentally, Job is an example of that, right? And I always think back to Ephesians 6, where it talks about these spiritual warfare that's going on. There are things that we don't understand.
Yeah.
I mean, and there's several different ways to address that problem of people asking why do bad things happen to good people. But it is a practical two-day conversation that I believe people really are sincere. Some people are really sincere in their disbelief in God because of this fundamental question that Job addresses. And to understand there are things going on in the background that we do not understand takes a degree of humility. And also it takes a bit of accepting that you don't understand everything. And that's another fundamental concept that people have a hard time with, especially people that are very data-driven, logical, to just sit back and go, there are things going on in the background that I just don't comprehend and don't understand. But the book of Job fundamentally answers the question of why, at least with one reason,
yeah, and he's going to kind of double down on this point when his wife tells him to curse God and die in chapter 2. He's going to say, shall we accept good from God and not evil? And that's the practical conclusion of what you're talking about. It's saying, why does God allow evil things to happen? Well, Job understood that we couldn't even know what evil was unless we had good. Right, you define evil because you understand what good is. If you don't know what good is, evil can't exist. Because suffering or evil is the removal of good things. You know, when you think about you have bad health because you know what it is to have good health. Right? We've got a frame of references. This is what good health is, and I'm not there. Right? Or I'm suffering because I've lost a loved one because I know what it's like to have a relationship with someone and how good that is. And I suffer now because I've lost that. So we understand evil because good exists. And Job gets to that point. He says, we can't accept good and not accept evil. But to your point, Joel, this is something that's debated even today. I mean, this is like one of the most common arguments you'll find against God is, why does God allow suffering if he's a good God? Well, there's a very logical answer to that. And it's, well, we wouldn't know suffering if we didn't know good. So you can't just take the good, and like Job says, we can't take the good and not take the evil, right? Now, as we talked a little bit about last week, how does that answer make you feel? Well, you know, God, he has a right to do whatever he wants. Who am I? If he wants me to suffer, it makes sense. I'm going to suffer. It doesn't bring me a lot of comfort. And there's kind of two sides to these arguments that are against God. There's, okay, we need to have a logical argument in place, but we also need to think like, okay, now where does that leave me when I think about my relationship with God? Why would I want to serve a God like that who may just change his mind one day and just decide, I'm done with you, you're going to suffer now? And I think, again, Job's going to get into both of those sides of the coin, and I think it's really great. We have logical arguments presented, but we also have, how do we find comfort in this reality? Kelly?
There are many facets to this. We had, for those who remember, earlier this year, I believe it may have been last year, a young family, our brother and sister in Christ in Tennessee, wife and husband and a 2-year-old son, their house crashed in on them during a tornado. That's our brother. Could we not ask that same question? Why would God allow this to happen to this young family? In a kind of stark sense, we don't have any really right to ask God that question in that sense, right? But here's the other thing that I think we have to keep in mind. I go back to Ecclesiastes 7, because I think it addresses some of this. And a good name is better than precious ornament. In the day of death and the day of one's birth, better go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men. And there's a lot here. Then in verse 14, he says, in the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. God has set the one against the other so that man shall find nothing after him. Could it be that one of the explanations for this is that God wants us to realize it's not about here? You're going to lose everything here. And if your hope and your affections are linked to the here and now, they're in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to demonstrate that for you in these different things. It doesn't mean that God did not love Job, because he loved Job. But it
Yeah.
But it's not about here. And I think those things are to remind us, look, this life is temporary.
And that makes a lot of sense. But what's going to mess with my head, and maybe it'll mess with yours, is the kind of stuff you're doing right now is exactly what we're about to get into with Job and his three friends. They're looking at what they know and what they've experienced and what God has revealed about himself to try to make sense out of this. And you know what? They didn't get it right. They didn't get it right. So that, if nothing else, let's explore some opportunity or some options that we might have, and let's look at what we know. And I'm not afraid to form some conclusions, but just remain a little pliable, right, with why these things happen, because that would have helped, I think. Yeah, Sean? I think that, you know, if we want to try to dive into, you know, practically, we kind of know what to do when tragedy happens to a person. You try to help and comfort them through it. And you try to point them to God and reaffirm that they can find their comfort and confidence in God. But I wouldn't be so bold. This is just me. To go trying to explain to one family why God allowed that family to die, but not that family. Yes, Rick.
Real quick, Doug. One of the problems we have is we put our understanding as humans on God. We put him in a box. And up to Joel's point, there are things we just lack and don't understand. And the problem becomes when we say, oh no, I understand exactly what's going on. And I'm going to put him in this little box. And that's what every single one of these people who try to help or hinder Job does. They put God in their own box. And that's what we do all the time.
Yeah.
And that's because that's what humans can do, because that's their capability. And again, to Joel's point, we don't have the capability to do that to God. So one of the things we have to remember is, even though bad things happen to good people, and good things happen to bad people, we don't have the magic key that says, I understand. We have one thing and one thing only. Our belief that God understands it and God has a purpose for us.
Yeah.
That's it. And that's all we can cling to. Any of this other stuff's fluff. That's the one thing we have to hang on to. And that comes very apparent throughout the book of Job.
Yeah.
Just as you said. And just as tells you, there's something else not here. And
right.
If we put it in our box, our understanding here, none of it makes sense.
Yeah, and the arguments that we're going to see that are laid out over the next, you know, 28 chapters or whatever it is, they're good arguments. I mean, they're good. I mean, these guys weren't dull. They were really sharp. And what they're saying makes sense. But the problem is, it assumes too much. Like, the logic is solid, but the foundations of the logic are not. There's too many assumptions that they're just saying this is the way it is, and they build from there. All right, I got to move on a little bit, because I wanted to make sure I covered at least a little bit of what I think's going on in this throne room scene, and we'll get into chapter 2 next week. And just remember, if you weren't here last week, I warned the class that I have a tendency to slow things down, and it's going to take more time. I'm not worried about getting through this too quickly, so, you know, I was told if after 4 or 5 months people start bringing tomatoes to pelt at me, then maybe we'll speed it up at that point and we'll get Joel up here. But until then, we'll keep working through this at this pace. But let me know if I'm dragging it too much. I may still keep dragging it, though. So God has already formed this conclusion about Job. God's judgment's being challenged. And, you know, I don't see this as like a 1 Peter 1 6-7 thing, you know, where it talks about how trials, you know, purify our faith. They have this refining capability on our faith. I don't really see that that's what's going on here. Although Job is going to come out of this better than he did before. Maybe there's a little bit, but I don't think that God sees some impurity in Job that he needs to work out. That's not what this is about. Okay. And as was stated, I think Jeff said it really well, God's got nothing to prove to this Satan character. So if God owes Job no explanation, then why do we feel like he needs to prove something to any other lower creature than he himself? So why does God indulge in the challenge? Well, one idea is that God wanted other people to learn about him from this event. Okay? This is there for our instruction. We have it, and we can read it, and we can talk about it, and we can learn from it. And if that's true, that would imply that we need to learn not just the end of the matter, but we need to really chew on the arguments that lead up to it. If we skip all that and just kind of gloss over and go right to the end and say, well, we know where this is going, right? And we do. We know where this is going. But what you're going to miss out on is an opportunity to really refine your own understanding and I think build your own faith when you're challenged by some of these things. Because just knowing where the book of Job goes isn't going to really do much for you when you're put through the ringer. But knowing these arguments that were made and how they were answered and where they succeeded and where they fell short may help. So the philosophical question at hand is, that this being proposes to God, is will a person with free will choose to serve when servitude is not rewarded? In other words, why would someone serve God if God repays that service with evil? That's the challenge. So if you take away all the good things that Job's gotten and continues to receive from God by serving him, then if Job stops serving God because those things are taken away, then it would prove that the devotion of even the most devoted disciple is just really like transactional. I'm doing it because I'm getting something out of it. Okay, that's what's being challenged here. So then the question that would come from that is, doesn't the servant deserve better treatment than that? You know, and if not, why not? He did his job. Why doesn't he get what he deserves? So the problem with that, as I understand it now, is asking a question about what man deserves. You know, we get into these deeper concepts and we're already out of time, so I'm not even going to get into like grace and works and all of that. In fact, let's just pause there and let's come back to that question next week. We're going to dive into what is it that God wants out of these relationships? What can we learn about kind of what's going on from God's perspective and what kind of makes sense to me in this? Is I think God is just, we'll get into it more next week, but I think what God is trying to do is show that that's not the type of relationship that he wants and that's not the type of relationship that he values. Because if it were, when this being challenged him, he would have said, of course Job serves me because of the good things I give him. He's my servant. He does what he's supposed to do. That's why I give him. If I stopped giving him blessings, he would stop serving me because that's our relationship. But that's not what he says. All right, we'll pick up next week. Thanks, guys.